From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a look at the fastest growing Christian movement on earth, Pentecostalism. We talk with theologian Harvey Cox. His new book, Fire from Heaven, looks at the rise of Pentecostal spirituality and what it says about the reshaping of religion. Also today, part two of our interview with Youssef Ibrahim, regional Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. We'll discuss his experiences as an Arab American covering the Arab world. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has some gift suggestions for the jazz fans on your shopping list. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Former President Jimmy Carter says the Bosnian Serbs are offering a four-month-long ceasefire in the Bosnian Civil War. The statement comes after 7 hours of talks between Carter and Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic. Carter says he'll discuss the offer with Bosnian President Alija Izetbegovic tomorrow in Sarajevo. President Clinton has unveiled plans for restructuring five federal agencies to save $24 billion. This is intended to help finance the administration's proposed middle-class tax break. Mr. Clinton says the measures will help prepare the country for changes in the future economy.
Now we are cutting things that can be cut. We propose to stop doing things that government doesn't do very well and that don't need to be done by government. And we believe we should increase our efforts where government can make a real positive difference in the lives of ordinary Americans. We have to change yesterday's government and make it work for the America of today and tomorrow.
Mr. Clinton also says he's pressing North Korea hard for the return of a detained U.S. helicopter pilot and the body of a second pilot. The men's helicopter was downed in North Korea over the weekend after crossing the demilitarized zone. Republican Congressman Bill Richardson, who is in North Korea on a prearranged trip, is working to help free the surviving pilot. State Department spokesman Mike McCurry says the United States hopes that Richardson can help speed up the release process.
The foreign ministry has been engaged in some of the dialogue that Congressman Richardson has been conducting in Pyongyang. We certainly hope that becomes fruitful dialogue that leads to the release of the remains and the missing airmen.
The Pentagon now says the pilots mistakenly thought they were in South Korea at the time they went down. It's not clear how they got lost. Czech police have seized 6.5 pounds of nuclear material. The International Atomic Energy Agency believes it's weapons-grade uranium. It's one of the largest seizures ever of nuclear material. Reporter Peter Green reports from Prague.
Police said they arrested three men, two former Soviet citizens, and a Czech nuclear expert with metal tubes of the uranium. The International Atomic Energy Agency said the seizure was a matter for serious concern. If tests prove the material really is weapons grade, it was about an eighth of what is needed to make a nuclear bomb. And if the Russian documents found with it are genuine, the material probably came from a Soviet nuclear submarine or a Soviet nuclear warhead. While several countries are all known to be seeking the means to build a nuclear bomb, authorities said the smugglers caught in Prague may well be freelancers. One senior official warned it was truly impossible to know how much more nuclear material is out there. One of the terrible things about this business, he said, is that you don't know how much you don't know. For National Public Radio, I'm Peter Green in Prague.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 16.5 points at 3,790. This is NPR. Baseball labor talks have resumed in Washington, D.C. It could be a critical week in the dispute between major league players and owners. NPR's Tom Goldman reports.
Players went on strike August 12th. Owners canceled the season September 14th. This Thursday, December 22nd, could be another pivotal date. If there's no breakthrough by then, owners plan to unilaterally impose a new contract, including a controversial cap on players' salaries. Players most likely would seek an injunction and stay on strike, raising the possibility that next season could begin with minor league replacement players. Today in Washington, the two sides met to discuss details of recent contract proposals. Owners still insist on controlling players' salaries, despite the fact that teams continue to sign free agent players to bigger and bigger contracts. Players, meanwhile, are adamant about no salary cap. If there is progress in talks this week, Acting Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig says Thursday's deadline may be flexible. In Washington, I'm Tom Goldman.
The judge in the O.J. Simpson murder trial has denied the prosecution the right to use a remark that Simpson shouted in his jail cell. The remark had been overheard by deputies as Simpson spoke with his friend, former football player Rosie Grier. This is a victory for the defense, but Simpson has received a setback, too. Judge Lance Ito has ordered a hearing on the admissibility of DNA evidence. The defense wanted to talk about the scientific genetic evidence in the trial with jurors present. The DNA hearing will start January 5th. The jury won't be there. ITT Corporation is moving to expand its Hotel Casino Corporation. It's announced a deal to buy the company that owns Caesar's Palace. The arrangement for the facilities is worth $1.7 billion. Caesar's has three hotel casinos in Las Vegas, Atlantic City, and Lake Tahoe. It also helps manage a casino owned by the Ontario government in Windsor, Canada, across the river from Detroit. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Pentecostalism is the fastest-growing Christian movement on Earth. In Africa, Pentecostal congregations are becoming the main expression of Christianity. Several Latin American countries, which have been dominated by the Roman Catholic Church, are now approaching Pentecostal majorities. My guest Harvey Cox spent 5 years visiting Pentecostal churches throughout America and around the world. He says these churches offer clues about some of the larger changes happening in religion today. Cox has been studying new religious movements for 3 decades. He's a theologian, a professor of religion at Harvard, and author of the new book, Fire from Heaven, The Rise of Pentecostal Spirituality and the Reshaping of Religion in the 21st Century. I asked him why he thinks Pentecostalism is growing so rapidly around the world.
In a word, they emphasize very strongly the experience, the direct experience of God, of the Holy Spirit, and not so much the institutional or the doctrinal packaging that most other religious groups make so central. So I'm convinced that that we're in a period now where people are really looking for that core experience and are not as concerned and sometimes even a bit turned off by the institutional expressions and by the more doctrinal and systematic expressions of religion. So the experience is there. Also, they're very communitarian. That is, they know each other. They support each other. The churches are organized, even the big ones, into very small groups where there's a lot of face-to-face and personal encounter and personal sharing. And I think people are looking for that too. I think we're at a period in which there's a kind of suspicion, perhaps similar to the suspicion many people have about governmental institutions or the media or other seemingly distant and unresponsive institutions. Some of that is also directed toward religious institutions. But that doesn't mean people are not concerned about spiritual issues and about value and direction and purpose and meaning in life. But they are not as willing to, as it were, buy the whole package now. They're sort of looking and searching for something that makes sense to them. And I think Pentecostals have more or less stumbled into this. I mean, I studied this movement in part because it gives me a kind of a clue or a window into a much wider and far-reaching phenomenon, even than Pentecostalism, which is the emerging late 20th century new spirituality all around the world. And this is a century when people thought religion was going to become peripheral or decline or become insignificant, death of God and things like that. This did not happen, of course. But the kind of religiousness which is emerging is different from what we've seen in the past.
What is Pentecostalism?
Well, the word, of course, the word Pentecostal comes from the story in the New Testament, in the book of Acts, in which the disciples are all gathered after the death and resurrection of Jesus, and they're a little puzzled about what happens now, and suddenly the account says their tongues of flame appear over their heads, and the Holy Spirit descends on them, and they find that they can understand each other, even though they're speaking different languages. This is the main miracle of Pentecost. It's the breaking down of the barrier of languages so that the, as it were, the curse of the Tower of Babel is reversed. And what was at that time the confounding of languages is now reversed, and now people can understand each other. And this is taken to be the gift of the Holy Spirit. And they were meeting on that day, Pentecost, which is the fifth week, 50th day after the Passover, because after all, they were all Jews at the time. Pentecost means 50 days. So they were meeting for a Jewish feast at the time. So they've taken the name Pentecostal. The modern movement began in 1906 in Los Angeles, California, when a black preacher named William Joseph Seymour became convinced that a new Pentecost was about to happen and was in fact beginning. That is, a new regathering of the tribes, a new descent of the Spirit, a new purification of the church, and a bringing together of people who'd been divided and separated from each other. It started as a very small movement, although from the very beginning, it was racially inclusive. This was one of the signs that Seymour saw as the surest evidence that the Holy Spirit was present. The racial barriers were being broken down, and people were all... This was at a time, of course, when there was increasing racism and segregation in America in 1906. But this was a reversal of that pattern, and he thought that was the evidence that this new Pentecost had started. Well, it was a very small sect, but during the last 40 or 50 years, it's absolutely burgeoned all over the world and is now the fastest growing part of Christianity, with somewhere between 400 and 500 million people who are drawn to it.
In Pentecostal services, there are often people who speak in tongues. What's the connection between speaking in tongues and the biblical story about the Pentecost, in which everybody who speaks a different language can suddenly understand each other, and, you know, God has reversed the Tower of Babel?
Yeah, well, that's the other side. The other element of the Pentecost story is they spoke in these languages which they didn't understand. And St. Paul refers to those later in the book of in the Epistle to the Corinthians, where he talks about the tongues of men and of angels. Now, I've heard this in many, many churches and many places around the world, and it's clear to me that what is happening here is a form of prayer, a form of praise, which transcends normal linguistic patterns. That is, it's so intense, so exuberant, so strongly felt that it just breaks the containers of normal language. Most Pentecostals I know do not believe that they are actually speaking an existing foreign language. There was a time many years ago when many of them thought that. However, now most of them say this is a language of the heart. It's a language of the spirit. And in fact, we see this same phenomenon in many other religious movements. Some people call it ecstatic utterance or words to that effect. It's got an intensity and a power about it which breaks through liturgical language, normal linguistic patterns, because of its sheer intensity.
Do people who speak in tongues say that they've been prompted by Jesus to speak that way?
Yes, most of them believe that it's the Holy Spirit enabling them to pray or to praise in a way that they wouldn't normally be able to do. It's a gift. It's a gift of God, which strengthens the spiritual life, which enables one to pray more feelingly, more emotionally, more directly. It is not something that one can accomplish on one's own. However, there are other Pentecostals who claim that you can help people learn how to do this, or prepare themselves for it, or ask for it. It is not. It is a gift, but it's a gift that you have to be kind of helped to appropriate.
Would you describe one or two services that you went to and how people spoke in tongues there?
Yeah, well, let me describe the services at first. One of the first things that strikes a person who isn't used to going to Pentecostal churches is the high degree of exuberant praise, bodily movement. People are moving around. They're praying, standing up with their hands over their heads. They're sometimes moving and dancing in the aisles. The music is very, very voluble and sometimes quite loud. And the music picks up on current musical idioms in that particular country, whether it's bossa nova in Latin America or rock or jazz or gospel here or whatever. They're perfectly willing to use the going popular musical idiom. And the speaking in tongues part can be individual people just standing in the church and speaking in a language which does not sound like any existing human language, but which obviously has some personal meaning for the person who's praying in that way. Or groups of people can begin to speak this way, sort of supporting each other. It almost sounds sometimes like a wave of sound, like an ocean wave coming along with swells up and down. For me, it's a very moving experience, even though I have not ever spoken in tongues. Being with people who are praying this way has a certain kind of power and directness, which I find very moving.
Some people think of it as being weird, right? I mean, truly, a lot of people, I think, are very uncomfortable with the whole idea of speaking in tongues and assume that there's some fakery behind it.
Yeah, I can understand how people would feel that way. Although, when you think about the whole scope of human history and the importance that ecstasy has had in the lives of people in other cultures and in other generations, I mean, our whole culture today is a very uptight one. We don't have very many opportunities for exuberant, ecstatic expression. I think it's a kind of deprivation in our lives that we don't have that. And I even wonder at times whether the need for drugs and the seeking after drugs is a self-destructive way of filling that gap that's left by our ecstasy deficit, you might say, in a very industrial, technological, and rational society. Well, here, under religious auspices in Pentecostal churches, you can have that experience. You're encouraged to have it. You're allowed to have it. I think what may be weird is not that people do this, but that so many people are deprived and never experience this vital part of human nature.
So this is what you mean, too, about the Pentecostal faith being much more experiential than abstract or intellectual or text-oriented.
Yeah, what you hear are stories. What you hear in Pentecostal churches are stories and testimonies. Very little preaching, which is discursive or systematically doctrinal. Also, what you'll notice is that there's touching, laying on of hands, prayers for healing, embracing. Often a lot of weeping. The very strongly felt experience of God, of the Spirit, of each other, in a society in which most religious institutions discourage that kind of display of feeling. You sit there, you listen, you may stand up to sing a hymn, you try to figure out what the sermon is about, and there isn't very much feeling. Although we accept feeling in other things, we're allowed to really jump up and down at football games or maybe for young people at rock concerts. But religion, which over many, many centuries has also had this emotional and ecstatic side, has been pretty much drained of it in our society. And I think this is one of the reasons why Pentecostals are appealing to so many people, is they allow and encourage that to happen.
My guest is Harvey Cox. He's a professor of religion at Harvard and author of the new book, Fire from Heaven, The Rise of Pentecostal Spirituality and the Reshaping of Religion in the 21st Century. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Harvey Cox. He's the author of the new book, Fire from Heaven, The Rise of Pentecostal Spirituality. I think a lot of people assume that fundamentalism and Pentecostalism are basically the same.
Well, they're very different, and there's a lot of tensions between the two. When Pentecostalism first started back in the early part of this century, the most severe critics of the Pentecostals were the fundamentalists, and you can understand why. The fundamentalists emphasize the inerrant infallibility of the biblical text. It's a very text and book-oriented form of Christianity, whereas Pentecostalism is very experientially and spirit-oriented. So the fundamentalists early on were the severest and most outspoken critics of the Pentecostals, and have been over many years. I think the two are often confused, mainly because both movements tend to have started about the same time, and started among lower class people in the United States, and have been confused by people who write about them. But there continue to be severe tensions. And it's really the Pentecostals who are the fastest growing branch of Christianity, not the fundamentalists. They're really not growing that quickly. They were for a while, but they've kind of fallen off and are not growing as quickly as they once were.
The Pentecostal faith started off as a mixed religion, ethnically mixed. But then there was a split, I guess, sometime in the 1920s between the black and white Pentecostals?
That's right. They started off in 1906 with what must have been a most astonishing mixture of people out there in Los Angeles at the Azusa Street Mission where it all started. There were blacks, whites, and Latinos all together precisely at the time when segregation and racism was on the increase in America. However, by 1914, the segregation patterns of American society had pretty much been imposed also on the Pentecostals. And they formed different churches and denominations, which were either white or black. However, just a few weeks ago in Memphis, Tennessee, the leaders of the main black and white Pentecostal churches all came together at what some of them are now calling the Memphis Miracle, and said racial division is not only wrong, not only sinful, but it's a violation of what the Pentecostal vision is all about. At the very heart of the Pentecostal vision is this notion that God is breaking down the barriers among people, among languages and races and groups and ethnic distinctions, and creating a new and unified kind of humanity. That was really the utterly central to their original point. I think that's a very, very important move and a rather hopeful one when you think of all the bad news we have to face in race relations in America. To see a positive and hopeful sign, step being taken by these groups seems to me encouraging.
My guest is Harvey Cox. He's a professor of religion at Harvard University and author of a new book about the rise of the Pentecostal faith called Fire from Heaven. Who are some of the Pentecostals who have become famous on their TV missions?
Well, of course, we all know about Jimmy Swaggart, perhaps, alas, one of the best-known Pentecostal ministers, whenever I would ask about him when I was writing this book, I found that most Pentecostals are very embarrassed to admit that he is a Pentecostal, and they would point out to me that there are good and bad apples in every church, and they didn't like to have their religion judged just because of Jimmy Swaggart.
But wait, let me just stop you here. Were they embarrassed by his use of television for fundraising and by the entrance of show business into the church?
Not so much by that. They were more embarrassed by his sexual exploits and his kind of arrogance in condemning other people because of that. And then sort of falling for the same thing himself. I think the mixture of a certain amount of show business with religious proclamation has always been a part of Pentecostalism from way back. I mean, Amy Semple McPherson, who is a name some people will recognize, I'm sure, the great woman preacher of the 1930s and 40s and 50s, she was a Pentecostal. She founded her own church out in Los Angeles called Angelus Temple. And she was the one who was convinced that a certain amount of showmanship, color, lights, movement, action, music, and so on, were important and were appropriate in a religious service. So, and I've noticed this in other parts of the world, that there's in other ethnic groups among Pentecostals, that using some of the approach of show business and television programming and so on is accepted and is used. And there can be a danger for that, but it's also a connecting point to people who are looking for something. It's a world they're familiar with, and therefore it can be positively used as well.
Who are some of the other TV celebrity preachers who are Pentecostals?
Well, there aren't very many others now. I mean, there was Jim Baker, mm-hmm. Jim and Tammy Baker, but then Jim was sent to jail for his financial misdoings. He's now been released from jail and says he wants to start his ministry again. But he's another figure, I think, about whom most Pentecostals are very, very embarrassed. In fact, what they'll say is we have to be very careful not to build up single people and single ministries in this way, the way these television ministries did, because it's just too much of a temptation for them to have their hand in the till or to use their fame and their power wrongly. And what they're trying to learn from this, they've told me, is to really concentrate more heavily on the local congregation, on the people that you are with on a day-to-day and week-to-week basis, and not rely so heavily on the television stars.
Harvey Cox, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Harvey Cox is a professor of religion at Harvard and author of Fire from Heaven. This is gospel saxophonist Bernard Johnson. He's one of the people we'll hear from next week in a special series of interviews with people reflecting on religion and faith. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Are you alive out there? I said, are you alive out there? What we've got, we'll get all in your hands and make you wave your hands sometimes. And we'll get in your feet and make you run when ain't nothing running behind you. It'll get in your belly and make you rub your belly. It'll get in your shoulders and make you twitch your shoulders. And if you got a big head, it'll get in your big head and make you shake your big head. I said, are you alive?
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, journalist Youssef Ibrahim discusses his experiences as an Arab American covering the Arab world. Ibrahim is regional Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has some box sets to recommend for the jazz fan on your Christmas list. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton is pressing North Korea to release an American pilot it's holding. A second pilot was killed when the soldier's helicopter was downed in North Korean territory over the weekend. It's not clear if the chopper was shot down. Mr. Clinton says he's been hard at work on the matter.
I called the families of the two soldiers involved today to express my concern, and in the case of the gentleman who was killed, my condolences to the family. And I told them what I can tell you. I've worked on this all weekend. I'm going to keep working on it, and we're working toward an early resolution of it. We're doing the very best we can.
The Defense Department has restricted some helicopter flights on the border between North and South Korea. The death of Chief Warrant Officer David Hillamon of Tennessee is the most serious U.S.-North Korean military incident since the 1970s. It also comes as both countries move toward normalizing relations. The nation's mayors say emergency food requests by needy people in major cities have jumped 12% in the last year. The 10th annual report on hunger and homelessness by the U.S. Conference of Mayors warns emergency food centers and homeless shelters may have to turn needy people away because they don't have enough money. Detroit Mayor Dennis Archer says the mayors are worried that children will freeze to death. He says the problem is not going away. The 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals heard arguments today over attorneys' access to Cuban refugees at Guantanamo Bay. Susanna Capiluto of Peach State Public Radio reports.
Cubans being held at the U.S. Naval Base are given the option of staying there or voluntarily going back to Cuba. Cuban American lawyers, however, want to tell the refugees about other possible legal options. Under a district court order, the lawyers were allowed a few visits to Guantanamo, but they want unlimited access, arguing the refugees have a right to counsel under the First Amendment. Harold Koh, head of the Human Rights Center at Harvard Law School, argued for the Cuban American lawyers.
If they were advised of their legal options, that the people might have a different feeling about their experience on Guantanamo. They might be able to hold on a little longer rather than go back to Cuba.
The government argues the Cubans on Guantanamo are not on U.S. soil and not entitled to certain rights. A decision on the matter is expected soon. For National Public Radio, I'm Susanna Capiluto in Atlanta.
Czech police have grabbed about 6 pounds of what they believe is nuclear material. They've detained three people in connection with the uranium. One is reportedly a Czech expert in nuclear physics, and the other two are from the former Soviet Union, but it's not clear from where. The Czech Republic's Interior Ministry says tests are still being conducted on the radioactive material. Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow lost 16.5 points to end the day at 3,790. This is NPR. Zapatista rebels are apparently mobilizing in southern Mexico. Masked peasants have blocked highways and barricaded towns as thousands of rebels have moved into nearly 40 towns across the state of Chiapas. A rebel leader says it's the first major military action since the New Year's Day uprising. Subcomandante Marcos says the movement comes because a member of the Mexican ruling party has been inaugurated as governor of Chiapas. The Zapatistas charge the governor won his election fraudulently, and the Zapatistas say the inauguration breaks their ceasefire with the government. More than a century after her death, a new book by Louisa May Alcott will see the light of day. From member station WNYC, Carrie Nolan reports.
According to the December 26th issue of the New Yorker magazine, Louisa May Alcott will have a new novel published next year. The manuscript was sold to the publisher Little Brown last week for an undisclosed sum of money. Kent Bicknell, a collector of Olcott memorabilia, bought the handwritten 300-page draft in 1991 when it was offered for sale at a rare bookstore. The manuscript was rejected by Olcott's publisher in 1866, who wrote that the book was too long and too sensational. Unlike her best-known works, such as Little Women, A Long Fatal Love Chase is a romantic thriller telling the story of a young woman who was stalked all over Europe by an obsessed lover. Bicknell calls it an adult book and says it will make a good beach read. For National Public Radio, I'm Carrie Nolan in New York.
Oregon's assisted suicide law could take effect today. The temporary restraining order blocking it is set to expire. Lawyers for Oregon State plan to ask a federal judge not to intervene, but a lawyer for the National Right to Life Committee plans to request an injunction. The lawyers argue the law encourages doctors to recommend suicide to patients who cannot afford treatment. Oregon voters approved the measure last month. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Youssef Ibrahim, has traveled throughout the Arab world for his work as Middle East regional correspondent for The New York Times. Last week, we spoke with him about the transition to Palestinian rule in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and why Palestinians are growing increasingly disillusioned with Yasser Arafat. Coming up in part two of our conversation, we talk about Ibrahim's experiences as an Arab American covering the Arab world. Ibrahim was born in Cairo and is a graduate of the American University there and the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism in New York. He's won a George Polk Award and the Overseas Press Club Award. I asked him to elaborate on something he recently wrote in the Times about a new change in Arab thinking. He wrote, "More and more commentators have stopped blaming outside conspirators for Arab problems. The new message in Arab intellectual circles is that the Arab world must learn to negotiate differences because this ideology of all or nothing at all has cost too much."
Well, this is the most remarkable evolution in Arab thinking, in my opinion, since World War II. In many ways, it started with the Gulf War. Because the Gulf War simply showed that there is no united Arab world, and that half the Arab world was sort of on a socialist development track. The other half was on about as capitalist as they come development track. And there was really all these differences have been ignored, and all the differences have been accumulating, and in many ways they exploded during the Gulf War. The Gulf War pitted everybody against everybody. So beneath all of this, the Arab intelligentsia had never died. I mean, the great centers of Arab civilizations, Egypt, Damascus, Baghdad, were producing writers and thinkers and columnists who've been questioning over the past 10 years whether we got it right. I mean, what happened to Arab nationalism? What happened to this conflict with Israel? Is this rational? And the other thing, of course, is that the Arab Gulf War made it absolutely clear that dictators are a total catastrophe. Not only Saddam Hussein, but Saddam Hussein and other dictators you wouldn't dare to mention by name. But you'd sit in a dinner in an Arab intelligentsia group house home these days, and you'd hear things like awful things about Hafez Assad, awful things about Muammar Gaddafi, awful things about King Fahd of Saudi Arabia, things that people, you know, didn't dare articulate and get into very clearly before. So yes, there is now a number of new beliefs. And in fact, it's a very hopeful development. I mean, it's the most exciting thing in the Arab world, that finally people are speaking out. Finally, they are asking questions about the Arab condition and basically saying, we want to join the larger democratic process in the world.
So is it easier now for Arab intellectuals to break ranks and think independently and criticize?
It is, and the momentum is almost unstoppable. Of course, there's a downside to this, because also the momentum of the Islamic fundamentalist movement is unstoppable, and it's part of this explosion of, if you like, free thinking and free expression.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, you're talking about two absolutely opposing forces that are blossoming at the same time, Islamic fundamentalists and free-thinking Arab intellectuals. And you've got the Islamists trying to stop intellectual questioning. I mean, a lot of the Islamists want to take over the education system.
Absolutely.
And there's a lot of denouncing now of the arts and of popular culture.
But you see, the Islamic fundamentalism is really a continuation of the things we've been talking about, this sort of completely dictatorial, totalitarian society where everybody has got to think the same way. This is just chapter two of the previous totalitarian dictatorial societies in which everybody has had to think the same way, except the other one was called Arab nationalism and Arab socialism. And if you broke rank with this, you were a traitor, you were a Western stooge, you were an agent, and so on and so forth. Islamic fundamentalism has picked things right there and continues to take them, except it's put a new label on them. It's called the Quran, Islam. In the name of God, you cannot think. In the name of God, you have to dress this way. In the name of God, you got to eat this way. In the name of God, you cannot read this, or you cannot hear this, or you cannot see that. In the name of God, you have got to struggle against Israel forever. And the liberal establishment is the other establishment who says, hey, wait a minute, this is completely crazy. We have to join the rest of the world.
My guest is Youssef Ibrahim, regional Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with New York Times correspondent Youssef Ibrahim. I'm interested in the range of reactions you get from people, both at the government level and individuals who you're talking to, when you tell them that you are a reporter with the New York Times. What are some of the attitudes toward the paper?
Well, some of the reaction is the same, you know, if you'd ask my colleague in Bangkok or in India or South Africa, you probably get the same answer. It will be, the New York Times is always seen outside as the manifestation, the reflection of the American ruling establishment. So in some ways you are carrying this heavy burden, which is a bit true, but you and I know is not completely true. I mean, there are many other papers, and this is a country where there is a free press. On the other hand, we are the best newspaper in the country. So, possibly even on a global basis, I mean, without exaggerating. And people know that. I'm not kidding. I mean, people think the New York Times is really speaking for America and for the Western world. In the Arab world, of course, there's the added dimension that we are the establishment of the ruling establishment newspaper of the country that is supporting and has supported unconditionally and completely Israel for the last 45 years. So that adds a little bit of an ugly, confrontational dimension here. Having said that, of course, most of the people in the Arab world that I cover, and in Israel, because I covered that too, and in Iran, which I cover as well, know that the press and the media that they have is garbage, and it is a collection of lies, and it is a propaganda tool, and they know that we are not. So there is a grudging respect.
In Tom Friedman's book, From Beirut to Jerusalem, which was his chronicle of covering the Arab world and Israel, he wrote that when he was assigned to cover Israel, it broke the New York Times' unwritten rule against having a Jew cover Israel. And I'm wondering if there was ever a similar unwritten rule about having an Arab reporter cover the Arab world.
I don't know what rule there is. It's a delicate subject. I don't think we really discussed it this way. But I did think that when I was hired by the New York Times in 1976, I was hired by Abe Rosenthal, who was then the executive editor. He did break a rule. I don't believe that in the big establishment, American media, that there were people who thought you can bring in an American Arab, let's put it that way, to cover the Middle East. And I think at that time it wasn't even considered like this. I mean, nobody sat down and said, gee, this is Noah's boat and we have every kind, so why don't we get ourselves an American Arab? I think the obsession at the time was, we got to have some Arab speaker, we got to have some Arab speaker. It may have taken a life of its own after this, but I think, let's put it this way, the debate which Tom raised in his book by saying an American Jew covering the Middle East, an American Jew, in fact, covering Israel, was much more advanced than the other side of the equation. After all, Arab Americans are still sort of a minority to which not too much attention is being paid.
Are you ever criticized among Arab people who you cover for airing dirty laundry in public?
Of course, I am. But I'm also criticized among, I think, American Jews who feel perhaps I shouldn't be there in the first place. But the criticism, you are right, among the Arabs is there. I wouldn't want to give it too much importance because most of the people I deal with in the Arab world are, in my opinion, intelligent people. Mm-hmm. And sophisticated people. And you got to remember that this Arab world has come a long way in the last 25 years just because of petrodollars. I mean, it has evolved tremendously.
Now, I know you were born in Cairo in 1943. You studied at the Columbia School of Journalism after attending the American University in Cairo. Why did you want to go to Columbia? And I'm interested in why you wanted to become a reporter. Like, what inspired you to become a journalist?
A reporter is very simple. I went to the movies when I was 13. I saw something called Love is a Many Splendored Things, which was William Holden, Jennifer Johnson. He was a correspondent who covering the Korean War. I saw the film about 7 times. So that is very simple. There was never any doubt there. And then I did the journalism. I was the campus newspaper editor. I mean, I really didn't think about anything except journalism. So that's why I wanted to be a reporter.
Was the press a pretty free press when you were growing up in Egypt?
It was a very interesting and very rich press, which most people don't realize. Egypt, that may sound chauvinistic since I am from Egypt, of course, but it is really the birthplace of Arab civilization. And the Egypt I grew up in was a leftist, socialist, and intellectually very vibrant society of journalistic society. At a time where, as you know, in this period, the 50s, 60s, 70s, the leftist cause was thriving around the world. So you had the benefit, really, of a lot of fine writing and fine thinking. If I say what kind of writing, what kind of thinking shaped my generation, I would say definitely socialist, slightly Marxist, heavily leftist leaning in general, and progressive in orientation before, of course, the big disappointment was all of these things. So it was a thriving, writing, journalistic society.
Were your parents intellectuals?
And my parents were sort of upper middle class. My father was a businessman. He was the manager of a big department store like Bloomingdale or something like this. My mother is just a very wonderful lady who played piano and was a housewife.
Okay.
But I had and still have my favorite uncle who was an irremediable Marxist. who has played a tremendous influence in making me read and think. And he was sort of, and still is, the resident intellectual of the family.
You're based in Paris, but you're covering
the
Middle
East. That's a very technical definition.
Yeah.
And before I came here, I said that if a single senior editor says to me, "How's Paris?" I'm going to blow up because...
Because you're never there.
This year, until this moment I'm talking to you, I've spent a total of 48 nights in Paris. The rest was on the road. So I'm based really on an airplane.
Hectic.
A bit too hectic, but it's fun.
Youssef Ibrahim is regional Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll hear about former President Jimmy Carter's mission to Bosnia today and how that went. Also, news of President Clinton proposing new cuts in federal spending, deep cuts in some federal cabinet departments to try to reduce federal spending and pay for the tax cuts that he's proposed. And also a special report on today's program by Noah Adams about Williams Syndrome. It's a condition that people who have it often are tested in school, both as, in some respects, mentally retarded, but also as gifted. It's a very interesting condition. We'll hear a little bit about what it might tell us about how the brain works.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. With the gift-giving season upon us, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has some unsolicited advice. Listen to and take a look at six new reissue box sets. Kevin says the music's good on all of them, but the packaging is something else.
When you're Christmas shopping for a jazz fan, it's not enough just to pick great music. You also need a package that looks good once the wrapping paper's off. One of the more impressive collections of music this season is a mini box from Decca called Early Ellington, which spans the years 1926 to 1931. The music's superb, and the sound is okay, but it doesn't look like much. Three CDs and a small booklet housed in a standard plastic box with kinda cheesy cover art. A more presentable early jazz collection is Columbia's Louis Armstrong, Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, 1923 to 1934. It's four CDs and a fat book housed in one of those 12-inch tall cardboard boxes almost no one has shelves for. Even some hardy jazz fans find 20s recordings hard to listen to, and the earliest material here could definitely sound cleaner. That said, this is a good set for developing an ear for early jazz. The program notes tell you exactly what and who to listen for. There are lots of classics by Armstrong's Hot 5 and Hot 7, and a lot of Lewis playing trumpet behind singers, including country yodeler Jimmy Rogers.
Listen all you round us, you better leave my women alone. Cause I'll take my special and run all you round us home.
Years ago, the mail-order house Mosaic Records offered limited edition sets of music by pianists Thelonious Monk and Bud Powell, which had been recorded for Blue Note. Now that Mosaic's leases on that stuff have expired, Blue Note has issued what amounts to bargain versions of those sets. Each consists of four CD jewel boxes and a fancy booklet stored in a squat cardboard box. They look good, and musically, they're outstanding. The complete Blue Note recordings of Thelonious Monk include some of his earliest records, where you can really hear that Maverick's connection to the bebop movement, and a live 1958 session with John Coltrane sitting in, issued here for the first time at the proper speed. Bud Powell was the bebop piano player, and his complete Blue Note and Roost recordings contain some of his absolute best, plus a lot of stuff from his emotionally troubled later years. Even then, his music still had stark grace. Buster Rides Again comes from 1958. There's another major Bud Powell set this season, of his complete recordings for the Verve label. I may give the Blue Note set a slight edge for the music, but the Verve is superior in every other way. Sound quality, extensive documentation, including interviews with Bud's buddies Max Roach and Jackie McLean and others, and beautiful packaging. The word album first got attached to records because old collections of 78s came in bound form like a photo album. The discs slid into cardboard sleeves you could turn like pages in a book. That's pretty much what the Verve Bud Powell looks like. The booklet and five CDs are bound together in a very compact package with no plastic. It's less than half the size of Blue Note's Bud Box, although it contains one more CD and a book that's over 100 pages longer. Another Verve reissue formatted in a similar way is even more handsome, a cloth-bound anthology called The Jazz Scene. It's sort of a miniaturized 2-CD facsimile of a rare 1950 collection of music by various artists, supplemented with a lot of alternate takes and extra tracks. Headliners include Charlie Parker, Lester Young, Bud Powell, and Afro-Cuban bandleader Machito. It also has Coleman Hawkins' pioneering solo sax piece Picasso, which belongs in every home, and two Duke Ellington tunes played by his baritone saxophonist Harry Carney with a string section. Music on The Jazz Scene is uniformly good and quite diverse, which means it's a good choice if you're shopping for someone whose tastes you're unsure about. Chances are they'll like a lot, if not all of it, and it looks terrific, with lots of nice photos and a cover drawing by artist David Stone Martin. All in all, it's the niftiest reissue out this Christmas. I wouldn't mind getting it myself if I didn't already have it.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Pulse, Coda, and The Village Voice. He reviewed new CD box set reissues featuring Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, Thelonious Monk, Bud Powell, and others. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a concert and an interview with Sapphire, the uppity blues women. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
If I call three times a day, baby, come and drive.